Good evening, everyone. Tonight we begin lesson two of Talmudic ethics. Ruby, if it's cold, we can. Are you okay?
No, I'm not.
You're fine.
Don't worry about me.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to start with a little recap of last week. Last week we discussed the concept that ethics in Judaism is about obligations and not rights. So we discussed the contrast between, say, we read the Constitution, right? Where it says that every citizen has a right to life, liberty, and happiness. And we said that Judaism, in contrast, says that a person's right to liberty or life, it's not a right, it's an obligation. And we have an obligation to preserve life. We have an obligation to treasure life. We brought an example, for instance. According to American law, if a person is drowning, you legally don't have a responsibility to save him. Jewish law, however, says that you are responsible to save that person who is drowning because it's an obligation to preserve life. Preserving and saving life is an obligation. We discussed how your life comes first before any other life. And finally, we discussed the concept of triage. In a situation where two people are in need of assistance, right? Life assistance. And you can only help one of them. You have to make a decision. So in situations like that, we discussed how inevitably you will have to have other parameters play a part. For instance, you look at the concept of a person who may be more valuable to the community, a leader, or a doctor, or a person of great value, a scientist, so on and so forth, or a lawyer, of course, so on and so forth. These people obviously would have to, we'd have to make decisions very quickly, and Judaism does allow for that. And finally, we ended off discussing the concept of one life. Life is not quantifiable. You can't quantify life. One life cannot be, is not more important than another. And the only time we say that you can actually make a decision and decide who you're going to save is when you're actively trying to save people. But when it comes to an opposite scenario where you have to decide who's going to die, hand over somebody, say, to an oppressor, then you cannot make that decision. And one life is no more valuable than 100 lives. Can't actively hand someone over. Tonight we're going to discuss, again, what we're going to be discussing tonight is the concept of euthanasia in Judaism. Assisted death, or suicide as it's called. And although it may seem like a depressing topic, nevertheless, we're going to focus on it from an academic point of view. We're not really going to make any world-shattering decisions tonight. We're going to look at the various reasons behind why either it is or is not permissible, and under what circumstances is it permissible according to Jewish law to not prolong life, so on and so forth. It's inevitable that everybody is going to have to deal with issues like this if they have not yet already dealt with it. It's just a matter of fact. Almost every human being has to deal with end-of-life issues for a loved one. That's the way life is, right? Birth, death, these things are part of life. Question is, when you come across situations, inevitable situations, how you deal with it and what your decision-making process is what we're going to be discussing tonight. It's also important to make a clear differentiation. As we discussed last week, there's a difference between saving a life and taking a life. So tonight we're also going to discuss the difference between unnaturally prolonging life and actively shortening life. There's a stark difference between the two. Whereas Judaism does not require us to prolong life unnaturally, and we're going to discuss this at length tonight, actively shortening life is a whole separate issue. And we're going to begin with a case, an interesting case, two cases that transpired not long ago, and they were addressed by modern day halakhic authorities.
Rabin?
Within the past, who?
Rabin?
Prime Minister Rabin?
Rabin, yeah.
but he was killed.
Alex Sharon.
We can discuss him, because that would be a good case scenario. His life is being prolonged, and for all practical purposes, according to Judaism, there is no need to do that. We'll discuss that a little more at length. But we're going to discuss two cases. One case is where a doctor writes about his patients that when they're he's a doctor for terminally ill cancer patients who are in terrible pain. And he says, although no doctor would ever question the ethics of administering morphine to try to diminish the pain, the doctor writes that morphine in its own right shortens life. It's a drug that although it may diminish the pain, but it shortens the person's life. That's the first case. And so he's asking, according to Judaism, are you allowed to administer morphine? That's number one. Number two is, again, another doctor who's just asking, when a person who is, again, also in terminally ill, is there a necessity to prolong this person's life or not? He's asking this to another modern-day halakhic authority. We're going to begin with those two cases, and we're going to end the course, again, coming back with everything that we learned throughout this tonight. We're going to readdress these two cases at the end of the course. Very important principles for tonight is, first of all, life, and we touched upon this last week, according to the Jewish way of thought, life is not ours. Life belongs to God. It's a gift. We discussed this last week. And therefore, because it's a gift, God gives it, and when it's time, God takes it. Judaism does not give the human being the ability to manipulate that which is not his or hers. It's not ours. That's principle number two. Principle number one. Principle number two, and again, we discussed this a little last week, is that every single moment of life has infinite value. We can't say that you know, the first few moments of life are very important, but the last few moments of every moment in life, whether it's the first few moments, last few moments, and everything in between, holds infinite value. So with those two principles, we're going to begin tonight's lesson. Let's start with reading the introduction. We'll start from this side tonight. Ruby.
Zach Dunlap was pronounced dead on November 19, 2007 at a hospital in Texas after he was injured in an all-terrain vehicle accident. His family approved having his organs harvested for transplant. As family members were paying their last respects, he moved his foot and hand. He reacted to a pocket knife scraped across his foot and to pressure applied under a fingernail. After 48 days in a hospital, he was allowed to return home, where he continued to work on his recovery. How long was it?
Till the very end.
Oh, very end. 4 months after he was declared brain dead, and doctors were about to remove his organs for transplant, Dunlap said he feels pretty good. What is this mystery called life? Where does it come from? How does it end? How can we detect its presence? To what point must we preserve it? And how can we tell when it is finally gone? These questions are the subject of our lesson.
So while we all know what the definition of life is, the fact that we're all sitting here and talking to each other, we're all alive. However, scientists have never really definitively proven when life begins, the exact moment, and when it ends, the exact moment. So we know what life is, we don't exactly know when it begins, we don't exactly know when it ends either. That's still a mystery. And part of what we're going to discuss tonight, as we just read from the introduction, is that in the U.S. today, there's this concept of the right to die. You have a right to live, you have a right to die. But again, as you mentioned last week, it's an obligation to live, and there is no obligation to die, right? Judaism tells us we have a responsibility to treasure and focus on life. The obligation doesn't work the other way around. And therefore, there is a problem with the concept that is commonly known, the right to die. We're actually going to discuss the very first Supreme Court case that took place about 20 years ago, where the first time it was addressed went through our legal system up until the Supreme Court. We're going to discuss that case. But let's start with a little video. This week I have speakers.
Every day of our lives, we are faced with difficult ethical
dilemmas.
Oh, yeah. We grapple with the high of the subtle and the complex, the personal and the communal, the mundane and the spiritual. The Talmud provides guidance to help us navigate these choices. Talmudic ethics, finding your way to good decisions. Until the time of our forefather Jacob, man would die a sudden death. Jacob requested illness, saying to God, Master of the universe, a man dies without prior illness and does not settle his affairs with his children. But if he were ill for 2 or 3 days, he would settle his affairs with his children. Said God to him, You have asked well. This will begin with you. Thus it is written, It was said to Joseph, Behold, your father is ill. With the advancements of today's medical technology, illness has developed from being a warning of impending death to an extended state of being. As medicine is able to greatly prolong a slowly deteriorating life, we begin to wonder how much pain a person should have to endure in order to experience a few more weeks or months of life. This lesson addresses 2 contemporary cases that deal with these wrenching issues. The esteemed Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I have some patients who suffer from terminal cancer. The excruciating pain they live with is unrelenting. In medical clinics around the world, it is acceptable to provide strong painkillers such as morphine that are highly effective in easing the pain. The question I have is that it is almost certain that these painkillers will lead to the shortening of the patient's life, although they are not provided for that purpose. This is because, due to the weak state of the patient, the medications weaken their respiratory system, thereby greatly increasing their risk of contracting pneumonia, which can lead to the death of the patient. I am quite sure that if we compare the outcomes of patients who did get morphine to those who did not, we would find that the mortality rate among those who did get morphine is much higher. Despite this fact, I have never encountered a physician who would question the ethics of administering these painkillers in order to lighten the suffering of a patient. My question to you, esteemed Rabbi, is, what does Jewish law have to say with regard to this question? Dear Rabbi Feinstein, I have a patient who is terminally ill. There is very little we can do to relieve him from his unbearable suffering. Are we required to provide the patient with remedies which, while not providing a cure, will delay his death for a period of time, or is it better that he dies sooner? Almost all of us at some point will be called upon to make these kinds of decisions for a loved one. Must life be preserved at any cost without regard for pain and suffering? Or is there a point where we may allow it to gracefully ebb away? This is the question we will address in Lesson 2.
I guess it's the same introduction that I gave. It's just a little more exciting video. So let's start with case number 1. We're going to read the actual case. And again, the question is life riddled with unbearable pain? Is it worth protecting? Is it ethically okay to prolong life that's full of pain? maybe an ethical problem with prolonging pain, right? Judaism doesn't say that a person has to live in pain. Pain is not a is not something that you naturally have to put up with, right? So, good question. So let's look at case number one on page 22. Harry.
I have some patients who suffer from terminal cancer. The excruciating pain they live with is unrelenting. In medical clinics around the world, it is acceptable to provide strong painkillers such as morphine that are highly effective in easing the pain. The question I have is that it is almost certain that these painkillers will lead to the shortening of the patient's life, although they are not provided for that purpose. This is because due to the weak state of the patient, the medications weaken their respiratory system, thereby greatly increasing the risk of contracting pneumonia, and it could lead to the death of the patient. I am quite sure that if we compare the outcomes of the patients who did get morphine with those who did not, we would find that the mortality rate among those who did get morphine is much higher. Despite this fact, I've never encountered a physician who would question the ethics of administering these painkillers in order to lighten the suffering of the patient. The question for you, esteemed Rabbi, is what does Jewish law have to say with regard to this question?
Let's case study number two, Eli.
I have a patient with terminally ill. There is very little we can do to relieve him from his unbearable suffering. Are we required to provide the patient with remedies which, while not providing a cure, will delay his death for a period of time? Or is it better that he dies sooner? Dr. Ringer.
So we have several questions now. First and foremost, how are these two cases similar and how are they different? Case number one and case number two.
Okay.
Let's start with similar. How are they similar?
Pain.
They're both terminally. They're both terminally ill. They're both in excruciating pain, and it's only a matter of time. The doctors are saying it's only a matter of time before, you know, their time will be up. So they're both in your pain and inevitable death, right? How are they different?
One is reducing the pain, shortening life. The other one is extending life when it's hopeless.
Right. One is actively shortening life. Morphine, the doctor says, will shorten the person's life. Number two, we're just not doing anything to prolong this person's life. Right? In other words, we're not going to give them extra medication or start doing heroic efforts. Because let life take its course. Not prolonging.
I know the epic thing is if you put a person on a ventilator, then you can't remove it.
We're gonna get to that. Yeah. The next question is: in what case does intervention seem more necessary from an ethical perspective? Case number one or case number two?
Number one
or number two?
Number two, I guess.
They're both suffering. And they're both terminal, so what's the difference really? I mean, you're trying to relieve suffering in both cases.
I was grappling with this today. I can't see a difference between the two. I think intervention would be equally necessary from an ethical perspective. In other words, intervention or lack thereof, in both cases, I think would be. Does everybody agree?
What if you have to say the quality of life? Like, do we have an obligation to respect people? For example, case number one,
the concept that. No, pain is a mitigating factor. I mentioned that a few minutes ago. And it's something we're going to discuss. In other words, Judaism does not require a person to suffer unnecessarily. There's no need for unnecessary suffering. But at the same time, and this is the quandary we're going to reach about midpoint tonight, at the same time, Judaism says every moment of life has infinite value. So can you say that just because I'm suffering, the value of life is no longer there? That's what makes these things so difficult. We're going to get to that, but it's a good point.
Who can decide that for you?
Well, if a person can make that own decision, that's the best. But inevitably, in situations like this, usually it's family that has to make these decisions. Sometimes it's more difficult for a family member to make it than for a person to make it themselves.
Well, that's why they have this power of attorney for health care, because they put their feelings, you know, that they expect their family to observe.
Right.
Yeah. There's another unmentioned factor is, we don't want to talk about it, but it's the elephant in the room's cost. But financial cost is devastating.
We're gonna talk about that tonight, which is another factor that can work against, right? Sometimes it can work against our ethical values. On one hand you have ethical values, on the other hand you have costs, and they fight against each other. And something we're gonna talk about also. Specifically with, you know, Social Security today. At the rate there's not going to be Social Security left in 20 or 30 years, right? And that's because people's lives are being prolonged. So the question is that a mitigating factor? Depends who you ask, right? Always. So in view of the Jewish mandate to preserve life, which we discussed last week, which one of these cases seems more ethically problematic? Which one's more ethically problematic? In other words,
the first one.
Probably the first one. Because we're taking an active role in shortening a person's life. Again.
I mean, the morphine is taking away the pain. Too much morphine will affect the surgeon system and the pneumonia. So he is not to get the morphine. But if he do get the morphine, having pneumonia, I then obligate him.
This will be answered. This is part of what, but those are all good questions. It seems, I was also looking at what the doctor mentioned, it seems that his understanding is that if you compare patients who were given morphine, any morphine, you compare patients who were never given morphine, right, people in this state, obviously you give morphine to people who are in extreme pain, and those people inevitably are very sick. His claim is that the people without the morphine will live significantly longer. Okay, now, obviously we're going to end tonight's lesson with saying that, of course, you can give a patient morphine. You know, that's going to be the end, that is going to be our end decision. But there's a process, because it's a question, you know, if you're actively helping a person's life, shortening a person's life, can you give a person morphine? The doctor was grappling with it. So we're going to analyze how we come to the decision. You know, I don't want people to think that, you know, Judaism is barbaric and says that you can't give the patient morphine. You could. But we're going to analyze how we come to that decision.
Is there a reason the editors are only dealing with morphine? Aren't there other painkillers?
That was morphine is the most powerful of them all, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And morphine, if you administer too much morphine, is like a bullet. It can kill somebody, literally, if you give too much. It's an adrenaline, right? Okay. So let's move on. B, the elusive definition of life. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, as we're all pretty familiar with what life is. We live it. We see people around us. Our heart's beating. We know we're all alive. But when it begins and when it ends is a whole different question that scientists always have a hard time with. For instance, is it the cessation of the brainstem function? Is it the cessation of cortical function? Is it extended irreversible coma, as we have on the board? Which one is it? So we're going to now read from Henry Knowles Beecher, who was a well-known doctor, who was given the task of trying to figure out scientifically, and I believe his papers later were actually used in our legal system in regards to what death is. So let's read text 1 on page 24.
Only a very bold man, I think, would attempt to define death. I was chairman of the recent ad hoc committee at Harvard, composed of members of five faculty in the university who tried to define irreversible coma. We felt we could not define death, I suppose we would say that by implication we have defined disease as brain death.
So, you know, even though this is interesting, our lesson is not about definition of death, but rather it's about the issue of euthanasia. Is it permissible to terminate the life of a dying person in order to save him from excruciating pain? And this debate inevitably will turn into the value of life. Right? What life form as who just brought that up before? What the value of life? What life form is worth preserving? At what point do we say that life is no longer worth preserving? And this comes to the concept of the dignity to, you know, the dignity of life, the right to die, so on and so forth. So when you have a system of rights, okay, as the U.S. legal system is set up, then inevitably you're going to have, you have a right to live and you have a right to preserve life, and inevitably you also have a right to do the opposite thereof. But from a Jewish standpoint, where life is not a right, it's an obligation, we look at things in a very different way. Our way of looking at it is that life has, as I mentioned before, infinite value, and every moment has to be valued. When we start deciding which moments are more valuable than others, in other words, obviously, second a child is born and everybody is looking at this beautiful child and it's, you know, it's going goo gah, everybody's going to say this life is worth preserving at all costs. But again, if it's a person that has terminal cancer and is in excruciating pain, inevitably people in the room will say maybe it's not worth preserving. But then the question becomes, and I believe we touched upon this a little last week, how about a person in a vegetative state? How about a person who's extremely mentally retarded? Is that life worth preserving? Who's to say so? How about a person who's born with deformities that this person will never be able to do anything with their lives? Will constantly be a burden on society from the day they're born till the day they die. And these are common cases that happens every single day.
What about the guy, Johnny, who decided that life is a waste of time? He wants to cut it off.
That's the next thing. In other words, if we determine, if it's up to us to determine when life suddenly holds no value, and we as human beings can actively participate in terminating that life, every human being sets the bar differently. We're human, right? And one person will decide one morning that I'm so clinically depressed, maybe my life is not worth preserving anymore. It's a slippery slope. It's a very dangerous slippery slope. When we start determining which moments of life are more important than others, where do you start, where do you stop? So, therefore, Judaism takes a different stance. And we're now going to talk about the right to die in section C, and we're going to read the actual case of a woman, young woman named Nancy Kruzin, which ultimately forced our nation to face this big question. It happened in 1987. Text number 2.
Does that mean I got to reassess my thinking on some of the models?
I don't think so. Some people forfeit their right to life. They turn themselves into vehicles of destruction, as we discussed last week, right? Okay, Michael.
At 2:47 a.m. on December 26, 1990, 12 days after doctors in Missouri State Hospital removed her feeding tube, life of 33-year-old Nancy Cruzman came to an end. For nearly 8 years, she had existed in a state of persistent vegetative coma, the result of injuries sustained when her car strayed off a dark country road in rural southwestern Missouri. The decision to remove her from life support was made by her family and voiced by her father, Joe Cruzman. It was a wrenching choice, but made only when all was recovered with the sandwich. The decision, it turns out, was only the beginning for when the Cruzman family requested in May of 1987 that Nancy's life support be removed, doctors refused. And when, in 1990, her body was at last allowed to pass from life, the action was the culmination of a long and painful struggle, one that followed its path through the bastions of the U.S. legal system against fierce and powerful opposition, including Missouri Governor John Ashcroft and the U.S. Solicitor General Kenneth Starr. Ultimately, the Cruzman case became the first right-to-die argument ever heard by the United States Supreme Court.
So everyone, obviously, we all agree, or at least most people agree, we accept that all humans deserve to live, or all humans deserve equal respect when it comes to living human beings. We all have an equal opportunity when it comes to life. The question, however, is when it comes to situations such as this one, where you have a vegetative state, where you have a person who is obviously in a different state of life than what we're all used to. That's where these decisions become difficult, as you know, and that's where the slippery slope comes into play. And as we read, the United States Supreme Court ultimately ruled 5-4 in favor of terminating this young woman's life. Incidentally, there were other cases where after 19 years sometimes people came out of comas, right? There's a case here in July 8, 2003. After 19 years, this kid suddenly sprung out of a coma. Had he been instead of this Nancy Cruzan and her situation, he would have been killed. For 19 years, yeah. He wakes up, and the first thing he says after 19 years was, "Mom, and can I have a Pepsi?" That's what I'm reading. The kid wakes up and says, "Mom, could you pass me a Pepsi?" She happened to have been in the room. So, anyway, let's read text 3.
The watchword of that. Burned at the stake by the Romans for the crime he
So now we're going to talk about the value of life. Modern philosophers, obviously, in order for us to say that a person has a right to live or a right to die, you have to quantify life in some way or fashion. Whereas Judaism says that life cannot be quantified. It's beyond value. It's not something that we can say, put a certain price tag on any segment of any person's life or our lives. There are other modern philosophers who say that life can be quantified. And there is a certain value we can place on life. Depending upon who the person is, what they're accomplishing, and what they're doing. So let's read text 4.
I don't understand this thing. The first place, you give a gift to somebody, you don't take it back. So I really agree with the idea that life is a trust, not a gift. Secondly, I have a real question about the statement, life is not mine. Life belongs to somebody else. I'm just in trust of my life as long as I'm alive. I have a difficulty with this statement.
Not that it belongs to someone else, it belongs to God. But just think about it. Right, somebody gives you a gift, a physical, tangible gift. It was mine, now I gave it to you, it's yours. Life is something that is impossible. Even scientists don't really know what life is. Can any scientist sit down and explain to you exactly what the life source of a human being is?
So what is wrong with saying, I don't know, I don't understand, I'm not capable of understanding it, rather than making a statement? What is the statement? Life is this or life is that?
Well, that comes from the Torah. The Torah tells us, right, that neshama, we're talking about from a Jewish standpoint. The Jewish standpoint is that God gives us a soul. God gives us life. He didn't give it to us, right, if indefinitely. We have it for a certain period of time, and he takes it back. That's a famous statement of God take, give it, God take it. So that's the Jewish understanding. And
that
it's based on...
Before modern medicine, we messed up all this natural, you know, life that in the ancient days, or before, just recently, actually... people lived and died because we couldn't do anything about it. And now we've got all this artificial means of prolonging life or taking it away or doing things with it.
Which can be problematic.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is part of the crux of what we're discussing, is that in today's day and age, and people are living longer and longer, and the question is, you know, like Ariel Sharon is a perfect example. He had a debilitating stroke. Should they have hooked him up to life support? They would have asked the rabbi at the moment. I would have said don't. But now that he's hooked up, and they go to the same rabbi and say, can we take him off? The answer is also you can't. So... However, this same modern medicine that gives people in terminal situations the ability to prolong life, don't forget, is the same medicine that helps people who otherwise would have not survived, gives them the ability to live long and healthy lives. There are children today born that live normal lives for 70, 80, 80, 90 years had they been born 100 years ago. We may have lost a great individual.
Even certain medications and basic medications, penicillin,
right.
certain vaccinations as well, that we would, I mean, people would not live past
right.
without the invention of these.
So you're right. So we can't just paint the, we can't just use a wide paintbrush and say that, of course, there are some negatives to modern medicine, but those overwhelmingly positive.
Positive outweighs negative.
I think everybody in this room would say the same thing. The positive by far outweighs the negative.
The negative is the bill that
you get. Like the famous joke you say, right? There's a There's a room room full of medical students, and the surgeon is training them. This is Ellie's joke, and they're all, you know, sitting around him. And midway, in the middle of, you know, open heart surgery, suddenly somebody runs in and whispers something in, you know, the doctor's, the surgeon's ear. And the surgeon stops everything he's doing, and he turns around to have all the students watching, and he goes, you know, we have a serious problem. He says, I was just informed that we're operating on the wrong patient. And he says, and your assignment, every single one of you, is to figure out how to take care of the billing. So, you know, it's a true. Oh, I thought it was a joke. I hope it's not true. Okay.
See a new Army bumper sticker? Signed with natural causes and wimps.
Yeah. So text 4, and we're going to make a very important point now. Text 4 is a very important point. Francis.
Once you're making judgments as to which lives are worth living and which are not, once we assign value to people because of what they can do instead of what they aren't.
This is important. In other words, as soon as we say it's not about who you are, it's about what you can do, now obviously a person in a vegetative state can do nothing. A person who's terminally ill can do nothing. A child who's born with Down syndrome can do something, but how much can they really do? And today we have tens of thousands of children being born every day with autism. What do we do with them? Good question. Continue.
Once they find out people because of what they can do instead of what they are, which means the intrinsic sanctity of existence for all human beings can be embarked on a dangerous exercise of lying down. What about the elderly? What about the severely retarded? What about the handicapped? Are they any less human because their productivity is impaired?
Who's going to be making these judgments? My problem.
So that's why Judaism unequivocally says we cannot make these judgment calls. And again, remember, we're going to come back to the concept of pain, suffering, and incurable illness. And we're going to talk about, you know, dying a dignified death, but to actively determine that because of a certain criteria, I can therefore actively end a person's life, Judaism says is wrong. Because today that criteria may seem humane, but who's to say that tomorrow, if we allow human beings to set criteria, tomorrow someone else's criteria may be something else, and ultimately we'll end up with criteria that is severely inhumane. So letting a human being determine what criteria is valued, is valuable life, allowing a human being to determine the criteria for valuable life and the value of life, we're saying is extremely dangerous. And therefore, say the case of Dr. Kevorkian, right? He was deciding that this person's life is no longer worth preserving. That's in essence what he's saying. Yes, there was terrible pain, and yes, even a person made that decision.
Yeah.
Even a person cannot make that decision. And the idea here is that the Supreme Court, in the case of Ms. Cruzen, allowed the family to determine that this child was no longer worth preserving, right? That was the essence of the Supreme Court's decision, that the family was allowed to decide that this life was no longer worth preserving.
Well, I think what they did is they took it off life support, and if she stayed alive, that's one thing, but she couldn't live without the life support. So
right.
That was kind of
right, and that goes back to what we discussed a little last week, and what I mentioned is that that's what Judaism then says, that we make a distinction between putting a person on life support and taking a person off life support. Where there's no need ethically to prolong a life unnecessarily, right? That same ethically, you are not allowed to terminate a life. Same thing. So now let's move on. On page 27, we'll talk about the Jewish perspective on the sanctity of life, And we're going to discuss two core principles.
Can I have a question?
Sure.
So what about situations where people volunteer to go for experimental examinations? Cancer medications or what have you, that with the hope of them working or, I mean, prolonging life? Does that no, or is it a different situation? Or?
That's pretty much, I mean, even if it's experimental, it's still, in other words, if there's, the key word here is that it's incurable. If a person's incurable, then prolonging that life, in other words, maybe you don't have to, you don't necessarily have to prolong the life, but if it's experimental, any experimental medicine has the ability, the idea is to try to see if you can get cured. We don't just use experimental medicine that they use, they don't use humans as guinea pigs. By the time they're experimenting on humans, usually it's because they think the human may actually benefit from it. I believe that's the case, right? Experimental stages are usually on animals.
Yes.
Hopefully.
We've done it.
A lot of rabbits, huh? Many, many guinea pigs and rabbits. So we're going to talk about the Jewish perspective, the sanctity of life, and the two core principles I touched upon earlier. Number one, life ultimately is not our own, and it's given to us in a trust, as we mentioned. It's a trust. We are given life by God, and we have a trust, as a trust to safeguard and respect it as best as we can. A real a ramification of this would be, the Talmud states that if a family wants to forgive a murderer, say a loved one was murdered, and the family decides, you know what, we feel that he has wholeheartedly repented, we want to forgive this murderer of his crime. And the Torah says you cannot do that. Because it's not, he didn't take your life for you to forgive. In other words, this loved one, the life, didn't even belong to this person. It belonged to God. He terminated something that did not belong to any of us. So we don't have a right to forgive this person. We have to let justice take its course. And ultimately, justice has to prevail. No matter how terrible this person feels, the Talmud ends up in saying that, you know, in the world to come, he'll be okay. He'll be forgiven. But we as human beings do not have a right to forgive this person. We cannot. Justice has to take its course. That's number one.
See that Christianity turn the other cheek thing?
No, we don't believe in that.
Yeah.
Justice, yeah.
Of the country,
yeah. Yeah. As we can't say, just because he's totally repentant and he feels terrible, you know, let him off. We don't have a right to do that. That's a whole separate thing. I mean, as you know, the Torah does support capital punishment, but my opinion is the way it's administered in the U.S. it would never be supported according to Jewish law. It would never be supported. You can't. First of all, circumstantial evidence is never would never be admitted. Today, entire cases are based on circumstantial evidence. Judaism, circumstantial evidence for capital punishment is never acceptable. According to many opinions, it never happened any court of Jewish law, even in ancient Israel, put a person to death. Basically, they made it impossible. And there's another Talmudic opinion that says that if a court of law executed even one person in 72 years, that was considered to be, it retained the name of a katlanis, of a murderous court. You know, they had systems, court systems throughout Israel. So if a court executed even one person in 72 years, that became known as a murderous court. So, you know, although they did, you know, the Torah does support capital punishment, but in order to put someone away, you can't be 99.9% sure. You have to be 100% sure to take a life.
Well, yeah, and the city's a refuge too.
Right.
Is there capital punishment in
today? No, only for crimes against humanity. like they hung Eichmann. I think Eichmann was the only person that was ever executed. There were only two people that were ever executed in Israel, and they were both Nazis. Only for genocide. It's the only exception. Otherwise, there's no capital punishment. Actually, Israel has a very lenient system, jail system. They try to rehabilitate people, which is a Jewish way. Yeah, just to lock people up indefinitely. But that's for a different time. And the second situation where we would see this in real life, that if life is not yours, is when it comes to self-incrimination. Right? The Torah, the Talmud tells us that when it comes to a capital punishment case, a person cannot self-incriminate himself. Because when it comes to monetary cases, you can self-incriminate yourself. You can, well, self-incriminate yourself is being redundant, right? You can self-incriminate, end. I'm looking at me, what are you saying? Self-incriminate yourself. You cannot self-incriminate. However, when it comes to monetary cases, you can self-incriminate. It's acceptable for a person to incriminate himself. But when it comes to capital punishment, it's forbidden. We won't even accept testimony if the person is self-incriminating. The reason being is because ultimately you are giving testimony against yourself that may lead to your own execution. And it's not your life. You don't have the right to cause your own execution. So these two cases show that life ultimately does not belong to you. It's not yours. Let's read text 5, again a Talmudic story, that gives us an understanding of this concept. Go ahead. Yeah. It's a good question. If we're saying that we don't have a right to terminate life because life has infinite value, irrelevant of which life, how can we terminate the life of a criminal? He did something terrible. He killed someone else. Right? But nevertheless, who gives us the right now to terminate that life?
But how do you establish the value of life if you allow someone else to take one?
So ultimately it boils down to the concept of this person, right? The only time that we do execute a person is when this person kills someone else. Right? The Torah says that the person who takes someone else's life, right, we punish him with his own life. And it's a very tough call. It's not that simple, but ultimately it's because by taking this person's life, in a certain sense, we're protecting the value of life, because he has so desecrated, right, this whole concept of life, that all human beings value. So it's tough logic.
When you read the heinous nature, if you actually read the transcript of the capital punishment sentence, the heinousness of the crime. They're usually multiple, vicious, mutilation kind of murders. You just say, you know, what value is there to keeping this person alive? If we keep this person alive who values life so little and demeans life so great, what's the value of life at all?
So in a certain sense, it boils down to this kind of logic.
I just feel like with the option, life in prison. It's not like there's no, like, you have to either kill him or you have to let him back out on the street, which I would be very strongly against. You know, I feel like that's unacceptable. How do you make the call
I wouldn't go as far as to compare the two. I mean, over here we're saying that over here we're executing a person clearly as a punishment. And if you remember last week, we were discussing that when a road up, when someone is chasing another person, say it was a little innocent child, right, and you have to kill the child before it kills someone else, we're not doing it as punishment. We're simply trying to, because we value life, we're trying to save life. Over here, this is clearly punishment, right? We're punishing a person for doing something so heinous and reaching a certain level and devaluing life to such an extreme that the only redemption is to then execute this person. It's punishment. It's very different than deciding which lives are more valuable than others. However, that being said, I did mention before, when I think it was Brenda that raised it, that according to Judaism, the way we practice execution in America would never wouldn't be acceptable.
Lethal injection?
No, in general, because incriminating evidence, circumstantial evidence and things like that would never be acceptable in the capital punishment. So, I mean, for all practical purposes, the death penalty, the way it's practiced today in the U.S., wouldn't be acceptable according to Jewish law. Because there's too much circumstantial evidence, and ultimately the proof is in the pudding. How many people are being exonerated from death row after they check their DNA? And a few people that already have been freed from death row. And I'm scared to think of how many people were killed as a result of, because DNA, before DNA evidence was... So it's...
You should preserve the DNA of people before you execute them for future.
Right. No, but there are monsters.
Okay.
And there are a lot of monsters that... There's not one person in this room that would think that would want to ever see this person again. And... And I understand that. No,
so there's no way of making one absolute statement about life as a gift and then at the same time making another statement. But from a realistic point of view, I can really understand in that situation why you're going to have
I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a little more research on it because you bring up a very valid point. I think it's a very valid point. I'm going to do a little more research and hope I'll bring it next week because it's a good question. Okay, text 6. No, text 5. You didn't read that, right? So it's your turn.
Okay. They took our cousin Hanina and wrapped the four scroll around him and ran around him with bags of wine, vine branches, to which they set fire. They brought woolen tufts, soaked them with water, and laid them on his heart so that his soul should not depart quickly. His disciples said to him, "Open your mouth, the fire will penetrate." He replied, "Better is it that he who gives gain his soul should lose it. And the man should lay himself down to sleep." Then the executioner said to him, "Master, if I increase the flame and remove the woolen cup from off thy heart, will you bring me to life the world to come?" "Yes," said the executioner. "Swear," commanded the executioner. Hanina took the oath. The officer then increased the flame and removed the woolen cup from over Hanina's heart, and his soul departed quickly.
As we see clearly from this, that every moment of life, or rather that life is not ours, right? Principle number one is that life is not ours, life belongs to God. Life belongs to us in trust. That's my handwriting, okay?
You know what Limbaugh says, it's great, we know that this program, he refers to himself as talent on loan from God.
Talent on loan from God, exactly. So, as we see from this story, it's a depressing story, but nevertheless we see clearly that he says, look, he gave it to me, he'll take it. I'm not in a position to start getting mixed in. The second principle is... Yeah.
Is the trust irrevocable?
Mm-hmm. An irrevocable trust.
life is
exactly. And the second principle is that every moment of life has inestimable value. And as we mentioned before, life is not determined by its utility, life is ultimately determined by the very fact of its existence. So let's read now on page 29, text 6. Erwin, you're up here.
Rabbi said, if someone threw a vase from a rooftop and another person smashed it in midair, the first one is liable for the damage and not the person who smashed it, for he had smashed a, quote, broken, doomed vessel. Rabbi also said, if someone threw an infant...
Again, you have to understand, the Talmud is very graphic. It uses sometimes theoretical points that can get a little hairy. So here is another one. They're trying to get a point across.
Pardon the pun.
Yeah.
Rabbi also said, if someone threw an infant from a rooftop and another person killed with his sword in midair, is considered some form of murder. But there is a debate between Yehuda or Yehuda and the sages as to whether the person that actually killed the infant is subject to the death penalty.
So in other words, the question is not if they're killing the infant. The question, in other words, what is not in question is whether killing an infant in midair, although this infant is obviously doomed to die, is murder or not. It's murder of sorts. That's for sure. This person has committed murder. So what's the difference, however, the fact that this child was doomed brings up another similar case, whereas the Talmud talks about a person who's been fatally wounded, okay, and is going to die. And you go ahead and kill the person before that person died. That person is called a trefa. In other words, he's fatally wounded. So the Talmud then states that we cannot execute this person, even though he has committed murder. In other words, you killed someone who's going to die, you have committed murder, but we cannot execute this person.
We are all going to die.
Well, imminent death. That's a good point. we're talking about imminent death. So the question now is, what's the difference between case number one and case number two? Yeah, but why, with the vase, is the person absolutely not responsible? In other words, the person who smashed it in midair has absolutely no responsibility, whereas in the second case, where a person, again, committed a crime to something that was inevitable, is responsible.
Talk about an inanimate object versus a human life.
So the answer ultimately is a vase, its entire purpose is in its utility, right? That is the purpose of a vase, if I can use it or if I cannot. The second that vase was thrown over the roof, its utility is gone. This thing is about to be smashed. There is no purpose, there is no utility to this vase anymore. So by me smashing in the midair, I did nothing. I shortened its utility had already been removed. The child, however, and this is the important part, this is what we learned from this little incident, the child, however, the fact that I terminated this life even a few moments earlier, I have robbed this child of a few more moments of life. And this goes back to what we're discussing. Since life and every moment of life has infinite value, even if I took 5 moments of life from another person, I have committed murder.
But it doesn't say whether or not the person who killed the baby. Surely the person that threw the baby from the rooftop would be the guilty one, because it doesn't say whether the person who killed the baby in that air, maybe he was out there with a pitchfork or something, gardening, or wouldn't that?
Wouldn't that mean that was
like a ripping action? It was purely an accident. The person with the knife is walking along. And some of the
No, we're not saying it was an accident. It was a deliberate. It was deliberate. It was deliberate. And we're also going to have to assume that we're certain that the child would have died. In other words, it was enough, high enough. Otherwise,
he wouldn't land at our
otherwise, it would be a different scenario. So again, the point of this reading is to show us the infinite value of every moment. Now let's go to page 7, which talks about, page 30, text 7, sorry, text 7, which talks about the concept of violating. Since there's no way of assessing the quality of life, and every moment of life has inestimable value, therefore when it comes to violating other Jewish laws for the sake of saving a human life, even if only for a few moments, we're commanded to violate the entire Torah to save for three things in order to save a person's life. We're going to read that in text 7.
A danger to life suspends all the laws of the Sabbath, and the more a person acts with alacrity in this regard, the more praiseworthy that person is. For example, if a building collapsed on top of a person, even if there is a doubt whether he is alive or dead, or whether he is even under the rubble or not, one must dig through the rubble to try and find him. For the Torah declares you shall live by them. The laws of the Torah, Vayikra Levis 18.5, even if one finds the person crushed, so they cannot live for more than a short while, the rubble must be removed. If there is any life in them at all, we remove from the rubble even for a few moments of life.
So as we see clearly that every moment of life has supreme value, and all the laws of the Torah are set aside in order to preserve life, even if we're not sure it's there, and even if the life is there, it may only be for a few more moments. Again, this all points towards the concept of the second principle, which is that every moment holds infinite value. And where are we heading with this? We're going to now skip a little, and we're going to go back to where we started. And this is the question that was asked earlier. So now we're pretty learned now in the concepts of the Jewish understanding of life. A, that life is not ours, and B, that every moment of life is important. So now let's go back to the original cases that we discussed, which is that people who are terminally ill, right? Two cases. One, and they're in extreme pain. So we have another ethical value, which is that we are forbidden to cause an animal unnecessary pain. How much more so a human being? Right? Judaism says it's one of the 7 Noahide commandments. You cannot cause an animal unnecessary pain. A human? For sure not. A human is not allowed to suffer. On the other hand, we have the fundamental necessity of prolonging every second of life, because it all holds inestimable value. So what do? Do we sustain life at all costs? Does a person have to go through all sorts of pain and suffering because every moment of life is critical, is important, holds value? So ultimately, we're going to read the next text is going to show us how ultimately Judaism says, and I touched upon this a few times, that a life that is racked with pain, we're not required to prolong it. Judaism tells us do not have to prolong a life that is extremely painful. And furthermore, we have no mandate to prolong a life even if there is no pain. In other words, if a person has reached the end of their life, there is no need to artificially sustain that life. You can let a life gracefully ebb away. However, there's a quantifier here, and that is that once a person is on life support, then we cannot actively, this goes back to what we discussed last week, you cannot actively terminate life. You don't have to go to heroic efforts to sustain life, but we're forbidden from terminating life. So let's read text 10a, page 32. We're back to Ruby. We skipped it.
We're up here on 33. On the day that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was to die, the rabbis, his disciples, declared a fast and announced that anyone who says that he has died be pierced with a sword. The rabbi's maidservant went up to the attic and prayed. Those on high, the angels, want our rabbi, and those below, the rabbis, also want our rabbi. May it be your will that those below overcome those above. But when she saw that he was constantly going to the bathroom, he had a disease of the intestines, Rashi, he had to remove his tefillin and then put them on again, which caused him great pain. She said, may it be your will that those above overcome those below. But when the rabbis did not cease begging for mercy for Rabbi Yehuda so that his soul could not leave him, she took a clay vessel and threw it down from the attic to the ground. The rabbis stopped their prayers momentarily, and his soul departed.
So here we see a clear case where this woman said, look, you don't have, there's no need to, you know, to sustain a person who's in obvious pain. You know, let him go. Let life take its course. That is ultimately our determining factor in today's day, in the halachic factor. That is the deciding factor in today's day and age.
Is that just physical pain or mental pain?
Well, mental pain, we're talking about life that is going to end. There's no mental pain that will physically end life. It can cause life to be in turmoil, but there's no scenario where a mental pain will cause a person to physically die. That's almost unheard of, or unheard of, period. We're talking about physical ailments where a person's life is slowly ending.
Severe depression or...
Again, severe depression is terrible. This goes back to what we discussed before, right? That's not a determining factor for us.
So it's only physical stuff.
We're talking about the physical existence of something that will terminate a life. We're talking about terminal illness. I don't think there's any mental illness that's terminal. It doesn't exist.
Is there an obligation to seek that treatment?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you get diagnosed with cancer?
Again, the obligation is to, if you feel that you can overcome it, right, then I believe that's the obligation. And I read different responses, you know, while I was preparing this class, I read different responses, and I did read situations where people came to rabbis and said, look, you know, we have a certain, we've just, you know, it's a certain type of cancer that's, and the rabbi said, look, you don't have to if you don't want to. But he said that, you know, Jewish tradition is that every moment of life is, you know, you can decide to try to seek treatment and it won't be considered a sin, right? But if you don't, it's also not a sin. It's your choice. It's individual choice. Again, but here we're not actively terminating life. It's just a question of if we should seek to prolong it. And that's the distinction that's very important.
Any active termination of life? Once you start, once you take another step?
Right. That's why in most situations, if, you know, people will come to me and say, look, you know, we're not... I say, before you do anything, make sure you ask. Because once you do something, it may be irreversible. You know? And again, these are horrific choices for anybody to make. Sometimes you don't have time. Split-second decisions.
I give you a case of my own mother. I didn't have to make the decision, but the doctors
And again, you know, these are very sensitive issues, right? Nobody, these are very sensitive, but they're inevitable. Everybody has to deal with it.
Well, what about brain death? Why do you have the legal test and definition of death? So
that, we read about that. I mean, this is a doctor from Harvard that says that you can't really determine death.
Well, you can.
Again,
how do,
how do we know when a person's actually dead? And determining death is the slippery slope. That's the, it's a danger. So let's go back to yeah. Go go. See, for Brenda, this is real life every day. For the rest of us, it's very academic.
But then that's also to save a life, so...
Well, just back up.
Establishing brain death
for
automation
is to save a
life. And then it's also, so they're not to save a life, it's to save any life, so...
If we do what?
Consent to automation, which is consenting that that person goes to the operating room and has organs
to do it. Well,
it's still...
Oh, you mean the...
What, you mean the diagnosis?
Well, if a person is dead,
brain dead.
But their brain
dead. But I think they keep their heart going. Don't they keep it going so they can?
Yeah,
I can't answer that question. I mean,
it's a very risky decision to make.
But then
two people are dead.
So many
if a person is brain dead, do they still breathe?
Oh,
if they're not on a machine,
no,
can't breathe, right? I mean, the Talmud basically defines death as, I mean, says you have the situation called a glacius, in other words, they're almost dying. The person is dead is when they're not breathing. Right? Because a human is constantly breathing every second. And that's something we can tangibly see. Right? Brain death is not something that we can, you know, 100% tangibly determine. Right, to say the part of the brain that regulates you know, speech, thought, and motor skills is dead, but other parts of the brain may still be alive. But we may consider that to be death. Again, so we're not sure. When a person's not breathing anymore on their own, I mean, there's nothing coming in or out. There's no oxygen going to the brain. So.
But if you're harvesting organs, and I
that's what
died on here. At what point are they dead so you can bag those organs?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'd use that terminology. Ziploc.
Somebody
brings
those organs.
And they
put
the breathing, the ventilator on you, right? And let's say they become the brain dead. If you're not supposed to ever pull the plug, then. They just keep
you on forever until some other thing
happens and you finally, then they say, okay, well, if you truly, truly, truly are brain dead, then you're not going to be alive by
anything
anyway.
Yeah.
Whether
they go out
and
cheat or not, you know. Because
then they die anyway.
Oh,
well,
God.
Well, if such a chemical, there's such a chemical thing going on that it can't keep up to that.
How long? How long?
I mean, if your heart stops too big, you're
dead
on
the ventilator.
Well, provided you're there and dedicated to watching the napkin, the sodium, the keeping the
yeah, give me a time.
Oh.
Not long,
you say. 24 hours.
So a person will die even if they're on a ventilator.
Is one brain dead?
No. Only a
I read it, the scan is brain and it's completely gone.
But there must be something. I mean, you can be on a breathing machine.
Uh-huh.
And they can stop that. Breathing,
but not enough. So maybe you have to be on breathing machine with your breathing back, but a brain that starts
down,
you switch off the machine, you miss
the death, there's nothing. I know.
If the stuff in the machine, when I show up, you will die. But right now, they're just keeping it going. That's what I'm asking for. How long can you keep a person who's laying dead on the ventilator? Because he's on the ventilator, how long now? 2 years?
Well, if they take him off the ventilator, look, all the situations we mentioned before, they didn't die right away, right? The seclusion lived for 3 days.
State,
that means that there has to be some kind of activity in the brain.
Yeah, the lower brain that's working, that's what they call a vegetative state.
Right, but the part of the brain that helps a person eat,
that's
on the motor skills. So, again, but this goes,
dead,
right.
Nothing is working.
And it's not a great question, and you are just breathing, you don't have the ability to cough and take a vapor. You're just very shallow. So you're going to get asthma and a pathway. So they put people on a ventilator to be able to control that, to be able to clean out the lungs, so the person is in the lungs.
From a medical standpoint, at what point do you go in and harm the cure? When you say, when are they dead for organ harvest?
We have two medical doctors confirmed that they are brain dead after numerous tests.
And brain dead is the issue, is it?
Brain dead.
I'll give you a thing I saw on TV once. This woman had an aneurysm. It was so bad that if they didn't do anything, she would die. But it was so bad that they couldn't do a procedure on it. This doctor from South America had done 19 others of these experimental operations, only lost one patient. And they put her on the operating table, hooked her up to a blood recirculating pump, and started cooling down her body. They sucked all the blood out of her, waited for her brain waves to stop, and he knew he had only a few minutes to get in there and take care of the aneurysm. They started pumping the blood back in her, started warming her body, and she just came back to life just like
that. Right, and there are cases like that.
Yes, it was really weird.
Text 10B on page 34. Eli, your turn, Hilda? There's more books. Whose turn? You're shearing. I just noticed you're shearing. There's more up there. Harry, your turn. Ruby Utis? Yeah.
Oh, it's my turn. It seems to me on occasion praying for compassion for a sick person means praying that he will die. For example, when the patient is in agony from his illness and cannot live, as stated in the Ketubot in regard to Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's main servant.
So this is a more contemporary, he lived in 1320 to 1380. He was called Nachmanides, contemporary compared to the Talmud. And he was a great codifier of the Talmud, and he says clearly that in certain situations, it seems to me that compassion for the sick is to pray that they should die. So now let's go to the first case with Rabbi Moses Feinstein, text 11, page 34. And here he answers the original question. And remember, our original question was question number 2, which is, if a patient is terminally ill, there is very little we can do to relieve him from his unbearable suffering. Are we required to provide the patient with remedies which, while not providing a cure, will delay his death for a period of time, or is it better that he dies sooner? The answer is text 11.
If the doctors do not know of a cure for a person's illness, nor of the means to reduce the person's pain, but merely know of a means to prolong his life of suffering, they should not apply this means. If a person who is terminally ill contracts a second illness for which there is a cure, it is obligatory to heal him from the second illness. However, if he is suffering and there is no known cure for the first illness, nor is there a means to relieve him of his pain and suffering, it is sometimes preferable for a person to die than to live under such circumstances. And it is probable that we are not obligated to prolong his life.
So he says we're not obligated. Now let's go to case number 1. If you remember the case with the morphine.
Now, unlike this second case, the case we just mentioned, the case with morphine, you're actively involved in shortening life, whereas the case we just mentioned, it's just passive abstinence from curing life. So nevertheless, in the case of the morphine, Rabbi Auerbach nevertheless uses a lenient argument, and let's read text 12.
Since the suffering involved in our case can be extremely difficult to tolerate, this is something that one must have pity on the patient and refuse his suffering, especially in light of the fact that suffering may cause the patient to stay even more than the pain indication.
So in other words, you are allowed to administer pain. There's another interesting take on this that I read, and that is that in essence, when someone is administering pain medication to a dying patient, you're engaging in promoting, in a certain sense, a better quality of life for this person.
The cure is worse than the
now, even though the consequence, right, may be shortening life, but nevertheless, it's too indirect a consequence to consider it to be an act of killing or even shortening life. In other words, the promoting the quality of life is paramount here when a person is suffering terribly.
There's a neat little thought here too. It says, especially in light of the fact that suffering may cause to have patient death even more than the pain medication.
Exactly. We can never underestimate what suffering can do to a person.
Right.
And suffering has proven time and again to be an incredible factor when it comes to a person's life. So now we have come to the, we've come full circle, and we see that in certain situations we are permitted to not prolong life, and in situations of pain our actions may even shorten life, nevertheless we're allowed to do it. Now, if every moment of life, and this is a question I mentioned before, has infinite value, how are we allowed to do this? This is a clear contradiction in values. So let's go to text 13, give us a little understanding of how Judaism looks at this contradiction and attempts to answer it. Yeah?
A single moment in a person's life is extra. Each person is given a particular number of days, hours, and seconds for accomplishing the divine mission in life.
So Judaism gives us an understanding of what life is, what our mission in life is. A person has a unique mission. We're given a soul, right? A soul is, in essence, a divine energy. It comes from a high spiritual source, and it's clothed in a body, which is difficult for the divine energy to be enclosed within a physical body because it's inhibited. Nevertheless, there's a purpose. And for the purpose of making this world a better place and bringing divine light to its surroundings, the soul is willing to go through it. But only as long as the mission is still viable. The mission is viable as long as that person's life is meant to live. As long as that person is meant to live. The second that person's life is up, if you're prolonging this person's life unnaturally, in essence what you're doing is you're keeping this soul entrapped in its body for no purpose whatsoever. It's time for it to go back up. It's done its mission. It's time to return. You're causing pain and suffering on a spiritual level to the soul, in essence. Therefore, Judaism tells us that you do not have to prolong that life. You should let it gracefully ebb and let that person's life end with its mission complete. Let's do a quick recap. Before we do the recap, I want to remind everybody that this Friday night we have a community Shabbat dinner. Everybody is invited to join us. We do it every 6 weeks or so. 6:30 over here. And everybody, please come. You said you're going to be out of town. You're going to be in town? You're going to come? If you can, join us. You have a friend in town? Bring your friend.
That's all I said.
Erwin, you're going to... What?
Yeah.
You can come. You're going to make it?
Yeah.
Michael, you'll be here? Try to come?
Mm-hmm.
Ellie?
You're
going to
be
in Oakland. You're going to be in Oakland, right.
Bat
mitzvah. I can't go up against that. Bat mitzvah of a granddaughter, there's nothing that... Okay, so let's go through the key points. What are we up to? Okay, what is often termed the right to die can quickly lead us down a slippery slope in which life is devalued and the sick and infirm are viewed primarily as burdens. Judaism teaches that life is not our own, but rather a sacred trust that we are obligated to honor. Judaism also teaches that each moment in life is of inestimable value, the last moments no less significant than the first ones. The very presence of life attests to a creator, thus revealing the world as a holy place. We discussed how God allots to each soul a certain span of life for completing its mission. And finally, while we may not shorten life by even a moment, we are not obligated to undertake heroic measures to artificially prolong the life of a suffering person near death. End-of-life issues are ultimately very complex, and once you consult with a competent rabbi for guidance in making appropriate decisions in accordance with the Jewish law. Next week, the right to life. I guess the course topic will, although it wasn't that depressing, but the course topic next week will be a little, these are the realities of life. So I hope that